the agency in 2015, and a raft of awards in 2016. RGA now had 6 revenue spigots. Its 2,000 employees and 18 worldwide offices harvest revenues first from what it labels its agency work, creating advertising and marketing campaigns, including the design and development of products and services for Nike. Among RGA's many unusual adventures, perhaps none is more celebrated than the ad campaign Nick Law supervised and the agency donated to the Ad Council, Love Has No Labels. Meant to show how love can knock down barriers, we see a succession of couples who appear as skeletons behind a giant X-ray screen. They kiss, embrace, dance, and when each steps out from behind the screen, we see, holding hands, same-sex couples, mixed-race couples, couples of different religions and ethnicities. The revenue from the software and products they create for clients like Nike is grouped under a second revenue stream, its intellectual property arm. A third revenue source is their in-house studios, which produce polished commercials and podcasts and social media messages for current clients such as Samsung, Google, Nike, Lego, Apple's Beats, Pepsi, and Mercedes. They crafted, for example, the Hear What You Want ads for Apple's Beats by Dr. Dre, featuring controversial athletes like Kevin Garnett and Colin Kaepernick tuning out the noise from mobs of haters by putting on their Beats earphones and listening to music that puts them in another state of mind. RGA's agency, intellectual property, and studio arms collectively produce about 60% of its revenues, and the products RGA creates produce about 20%. Another 5% of its revenues comes from a fourth revenue source, ventures, which is what RGA calls its accelerator program, providing venture capital to startups and, as Andreessen Horowitz does in Silicon Valley, offering mentoring services to these baby companies. Absent the mentoring services, investing in startups, including brands, is what Gary Vaynerchuk does. But RGA's ventures, started in 2013, is much broader. Out of 1,370 worldwide applicants and counting, RGA selected 66 companies, a number that was expected to swell to 100 by the end of 2017. In return for their money and services, Greenberg says RGA receives between 1-6% ownership, and when these companies go public or are acquired, RGA will profit. RGA makes money from this program in another way as well. They invite clients like Snapchat and the Dodgers and Verizon to help select startups that might offer knowledge capital to these established companies. Between RGA and the established companies, they offer mentoring to the startups. RGA provides the office space and assigns staff members to work with them. And in return, RGA charges them fees that produce, Greenberg says, 11-15% margins for RGA. One such incubated company is Alveo. It is a mobile game controller that allows children with asthma to breathe into a plastic handheld wireless device that controls games, allowing kids to strengthen their breathing, and parents to monitor whether their child's breathing is improving through data sent to the company's cloud. At first, Alveo designed their wireless device for athletes. RGA's market research, Stephen Plumley says, convinced them to focus on kids with asthma, the third largest cause of hospitalization for children under 15. RGA also designed the children's games. Additionally, RGA works with other connected companies, including Snaptivity, which captures and analyzes fan reactions at live events to decide who to photograph, and Owlet, a baby's sock with embedded chips that forwards an infant's vital signs to parents on their smartphone app. A fifth revenue source is consulting, generating 10% of RGA's revenues. Greenberg says they consult directly with C-suite executives, just as the major consulting companies do. Walmart was a consulting client. Its CEO hired RGA to boost innovation and to help design an app and systems to better compete online against Amazon. The Campbell Soup Company was another client. Unlike the consultant companies, who he says leave after their PowerPoint presentations, RGA stays and tries to offer the kind of creative input they tender Nike. A final source of revenue, about 5%, comes from what RGA calls architecture, a group of engineers and designers that devise companies' working environments. The group designs offices that replicate what Greenberg has done, not just in his office but his glassed weekend home, perched on 200 acres overlooking the Hudson River in Ghent, New York, modeled on Mies van der Rohe's Farnsworth House. "I have the world's most connected house," Greenberg says, lifting an iPad and pressing to open the front gate, showing how from this device he can learn the temperature outside, control the lights, shades, heat, solar panels, and the cameras in Ghent or in his 8,000-square-foot Chelsea loft. "When people talk about connected space, I am really doing it." Greenberg says this growing business generates $25 million and includes the connected hotel rooms they designed for Lowe's and offices for Walmart, Nike, and Du, Dubai's telephone company. The office design, consulting, and ventures are expanding faster than marketing and advertising, Greenberg says. And he asserts that if RGA pulled out the actual revenues its IP, ventures and consulting, and architecture generated, it would total close to one-third of RGA's revenues. Greenberg's demeanor is modest. His voice is faint. And he speaks excruciatingly slowly. He does not tout the awards he has personally won. But he is immodest about RGA's goals. "We could disrupt the holding companies," he declares. "We could disrupt the consulting business. We can disrupt architectural firms. We can disrupt the production studios. We can disrupt the venture business. And we're doing all that." One thing he is not disrupting is advertising's lack of diversity. Although he often invokes the word diversity to describe a necessary ingredient of future agencies, only 6 of the 36 top executives pictured on RGA's website are female, and none appear to be black. Greenberg calls to mind a famous description of Samuel Johnson: temperamentally, always in revolt. He looks it, driving to work attired completely in black, including a black leather jacket and black scarf in colder months, zooming between lanes on his powerful Ducati 1199 Panigale S motorcycle. His business hero was the late Steve Jobs, whom he describes as a fellow rebel, a person I look to. "He had no patience, neither do I, with people who get in the way of progress." Like Jobs did, Greenberg has a passion for simple, beautiful artistic design. He is said to be the world's largest individual collector of Chinese Buddhist art from the Qi and Wei dynasties. Greenberg grew up in a working-class Chicago home. He was a terrible student. "I struggled with academics because I was really dyslexic," he says. He enrolled in Parsons College in Iowa and later transferred to Arizona State, where he majored in communications and advertising. After graduation, his uncle, who had sold his business to Royal Crown Cola and served as an executive there, offered him a bottom-rung sales job in Chicago. He sold mirrors and was pretty good at it. "By this point, I was married with a child who turned out not to be mine." He got divorced, and to escape he moved to Toronto, where his uncle helped him get a job managing a Royal Crown plant. "I gained confidence because of my uncle, who mentored me," he says. "So much confidence that he and his brother Richard, who was doing motion graphics and title designs for movies, decided to team up in 1977 and create a special effects company in New York, R. Greenberg Associates. They created the first integrated computer-assisted production process." Dyslexia imposes many burdens, he believes, but brings with it pattern recognition, or the ability to glimpse the new world technologies will introduce. With Richard as the designer and Robert as the cameraman and producer, their computer-assisted filmmaking company soon employed 200 people. They created the opening title sequence for Superman in 1978 and the title designs for many movies and trailers, as well as special effects for many others. In 1986, their work won them a Technical Academy Award. Bob saw another pattern. Technology was fundamentally changing the advertising business. He had a leg up because he and his brother were immersed early in the digital revolution. "I wanted to reinvent the agency business," he says. "You couldn't say that because it's very arrogant. Yet the more I got into it, the more I saw it was possible." Bob wanted to create an interactive ad agency. Richard wanted to go to Hollywood and produce and direct movies. Bob's first client was IBM, which retained RGA to redesign its website, and it soon became the digital agency for clients like Nike, Verizon, and Nokia. RGA received an infusion of capital when it was acquired by True North Communications in 1995, and again when True North was acquired by IPG in 2001. "What I'm interested in is to have a new model to replace the traditional agency model," Greenberg says. He rejects AT&T's new model. The work RGA did for Nike illustrates what he believes will be the hub of a future model that relies more on marketing than advertising. People want to interact with brands and avoid annoying advertising. Either on Facebook, its website, email, or IM, innovations like Nike's Fuel Band and its membership clubs create a one-to-one relationship between customer and brand, giving Nike a loyal customer base to share new products with, and a vehicle to provide two-way communication between customer and brand. "When I come to New York, I ask to see him," says marketing consultant and former Procter & Gamble CMO Jim Stengel. "I think he has the most forward-looking operation of anyone. I wanted to hire his agency when I was at P&G, but my clients would not agree." Like his business heroes, Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos, Bob Greenberg does not lack for confidence. Unlike Jobs, he does not glare at or scream at underlings. Unlike Bezos, he does not have a high-pitched laugh. Unlike both, he does not treat his work as if it were a national security secret. However, like them, his self-confidence borders on messianic. Near the close of a long conversation in his conference room, Greenberg was asked, "What do you worry about?" "We don't worry about anyone displacing us." Turning to Barry Waxman, he says, "Do we worry about anyone?" "We don't," Waxman says. "Personally, I'm Jewish. You can't stop worrying," says Greenberg. But his worry is more personal, centered on nearing 70. "I'm worried that I'm going to run out of runway, which is time." 18. Goodbye, old advertising axioms. The thought many marketers tried to banish is whether for consumers, spoiled by Netflix and YouTube, by ad-skipping DVRs and ad blockers, by personal devices we hold in our hands, the interruptive ad message may be a relic. Are consumers irrevocably alienated by sales pitches? Has the consumer, on whom marketing relies, become a frenemy? An eternal verity of the advertising and marketing business is that no one can be certain about what advertising will work. Longtime advertising sage Jeremy Bullmore recalls meeting an old friend for lunch outside London. When they stepped from the restaurant, the friend pointed to his shiny new Aston Martin. "Well done," Bullmore said. "I bought it because of an advertisement," the friend said. "Good to know what we do works," Bullmore said. "I saw the advertisement when I was 14, the friend responded. "How," Bullmore asks, "do you attribute that £75,000 purchase to an ad that ran 52 years earlier? Even with digital ads, whose clicks are more easily measured, if his friend had clicked on the Aston Martin website," Bullmore says, "the click would get the credit for the purchase. But nobody would know and could possibly calculate what led to the click in the first place." He believes the mysteries of what shapes a purchase are largely impenetrable. The mysteries of marketing were underscored by the election of Donald Trump. A month after the 2016 presidential election, Michael Kasson moderated a panel at the Paley Center for Media in Midtown Manhattan. The panel's topic was the anticipated big advertising trends ahead in 2017 and beyond. Introducing the topic, Kasson recited some stark facts. 62% of Americans get their news from Facebook. 90% of Americans consult a second screen while watching TV. The attention span of a goldfish, 9 seconds, according to a Microsoft study, exceeds that of a human, 8 seconds. An initial advertising prediction was offered by Arpita Chowdhury, a digital marketing vice president at Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, who said, 2017 and beyond is going to be the year for data. Data is going to be the new oil. With the surprising election of Donald Trump in mind, Kasson wondered whether there were some lessons to be learned from the contest, especially about data. People are going to question data more, he said, because the projections said there was a 91% chance on the morning of the election that Hillary Clinton would be president. Data from the polls and the predictions of prognosticators were dead wrong. Donald Trump's success in winning the Republican nomination and his election as president challenged not just conventional political wisdom, but some cherished precepts of advertising and marketing. Starting with the assumption that there is a meaningful relationship between vast expenditures on advertising and the electoral outcome. Jeb Bush spent $80.2 million on ads, nearly 5 times Trump's expenditures. Trump and his Independent and Republican Party PAC raised over $500 million less than Clinton, and Clinton reportedly spent more than 2 times what Trump spent on advertising. In an era when advertising is increasingly perceived as an interruption, more ad dollars appeared to equal fewer votes. Trump's campaign shrewdly spent more money on targeted digital messages to pull his supporters to the polls. A second axiom, that public relations usually belongs in the back of the advertising caravan because it can't be counted on, did not fare well. Traditionally, marketers want to spend more for paid media, worrying that the free media generated by news stories can't be relied upon the way a 30-second ad can. Historically, unpredictable free media does not deliver for most candidates. It did for Trump. His campaign relied on media coverage, and the what's-he-going-to-say-next fascination with Trump boosted TV ratings and newspaper circulation. When Donald Trump was attracting television audiences in 2016, Les Moonves told a reporter after Trump won the New Hampshire primary that the campaign was a circus. But he was pleased, nevertheless. Man, who would have expected the ride we're all having right now? The money's rolling in and this is fun. This is going to be very good for us. Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say. But bring it on, Donald. Keep going. Critics howled at Moonves for cheering on the circus because it was good for CBS. Months later, I asked Moonves, who was a Hillary Clinton supporter, to explain his crude words. It was a joke, he answered. It was said in front of 300 bankers. I got them to laugh. It may have been a wisecrack, but for CBS and much of the press that slavishly devoted airtime and front-page treatment to Trump in 2015 and 2016, it was true. Trump was good for ratings and circulation. His coverage harmed journalistic credibility because it revealed journalists were not always chasing what was news or important, but rather what was good for business. MediaQuant, a firm that computes the financial value of media coverage pegged to advertising rates, concluded that by the spring of 2016, Trump earned close to $2 billion in free press attention, far eclipsing his Republican or Democratic adversaries. Studies of the general election revealed he received more press attention than Clinton, and even though much of it was negative, it did not deter his hardcore supporters who blamed the fake news press. A third marketing axiom, that celebrity endorsements are valuable, backfired on Hillary Clinton. Clinton's rallies in the final days were headlined by Jay-Z and Beyoncé, by Bruce Springsteen and Katy Perry. Without dissent from his panel, Kasson asserted, "Celebrity endorsements turned out to be a negative. They served to reinforce the impression that Clinton was an elitist, and Trump was the outsider." The Trump campaign did buttress an emerging marketing axiom: targeting works. It is one adopted by Nike and by every modern president who used technology to communicate directly with citizens. While polling data failed Clinton, targeting data assisted Trump. Relying on the sophisticated targeting work of Cambridge Analytica, a privately held data mining firm that assembled what it said were 3,000 to 5,000 pieces of data on each potential Trump supporter, the campaign pumped money into Facebook and social network messages. In an interview with 60 Minutes days after the election, Trump bragged of his success at circumventing the press on Facebook and Twitter. "I think that social media has more power than the money they spent. And I think, maybe to a certain extent, I proved that." Martin Sorrell believes the digital targeting and messaging undertaken by the Trump campaign was vindication, in a way, of all the stuff we're doing with programmatic advertising and the use of technology. "The reliance on data," he continued, "is highly supportive of the way we see the business going. It's not good news for Don Draper." Bank of America's Ann Finucane, a dejected Clinton supporter, was impressed with how Trump communicated directly with his customers. "This is what brands like Nike do with Nike Plus and its Fuel Band and the creation of a Nike membership community. It's what Unilever is doing with the members of its Dollar Shave Club. And it's what Finucane aims to do with her bank and Merrill Lynch's 50 million customers." "Trump's success in building a community," she said, "makes me think of going directly to our customers more often." There was at least one other parallel between the Trump effort and many advertising campaigns: Trump's well-documented use of hyperbole and untrue claims, what Stephen Colbert has labeled truthiness, replicates the exaggerated, emotionally manipulative claims of too much advertising. In this sense, Trump was at least partially copying, not innovating, though a president's falsehoods are far more consequential. Trump's victory injected more uncertainty into the marketing and media industry, especially since he is not anchored to a predictable ideology or core Republican/conservative convictions. With media consolidation accelerating, right after the election, media and tech executives were asking, "Would the Trump administration approve the announced acquisition of Time Warner by AT&T?" Outraged by what he gratuitously labels as its fake news, would he hold AT&T hostage and demand it shed or punish CNN? Would the new administration and the Congress alter the tax code to end the immediate write-off of all advertising expenses, as the Republican chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee advocates? Days after the election, the ANA wrote its members and cautioned that if Trump and the Congress did this, it would cost advertisers and agencies up to $200 billion. Might Trump punish media and advertisers by having the FTC crack down on native advertising? Would Trump and the Congress rescind the privacy protections imposed by Obama's FCC? Might the Trump administration restrict immigration, including of the qualified engineers digital efforts require? Might his Justice Department assert that digital giants, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, had monopoly power? What would Trump do with the net neutrality rules promulgated by the Obama administration, which are opposed by telephone and cable broadband providers and embraced by media and tech companies who stream their content via the Internet? The net neutrality rules were seen as especially significant by outgoing FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler, who somberly said in a conversation we had weeks before he departed that equal broadband access was vital to advertisers. Martin Sorrell ought to care about the ability of folks advertising on IP-based services being able to freely reach consumers in a fast, fair, and open net. "Consumers," he continued, "want access to advertiser-supported content, without somebody setting the terms of how you can get there or, worst of all, do what DirecTV once did, which was to learn of an attractive business and jump into that business themselves and give it away for free. This monopolist behavior is why federal courts ruled against Microsoft when it crippled the Netscape browser by giving away its own Internet Explorer browser for free. Within weeks of taking office, the new Trump administration and the Republican Congress did roll back the privacy strictures of the Obama administration. And in November 2017, FCC Chair Ajit Pai proposed to scrap the Obama administration's net neutrality rules. He did this on the same day Trump's Justice Department announced it would block the merger of AT&T and Time Warner as a violation of antitrust laws. The changing rules of the game in Washington only heightened the advertising and marketing world's sense of turmoil. Yes, agencies were increasingly troubled that clients were treating them as extraneous middlemen by performing more agency functions in-house. Yes, they were not happy that their customers, media platforms, now vied to become ad agencies. Yes, they worried about competition from consulting companies. And yes, they obsessed about the growing power of procurement officers and the escalating mistrust between agency and client fanned by John Mandel's accusations and the resulting ANA report. But these could all be categorized as competitive challenges, not existential threats. The digital giants, however, particularly Facebook and Google, might pose an existential threat. By their nature, these companies are disruptors. They want to eradicate extraneous middlemen. They may begin in one industry, but when they spot new opportunities, they seize them. Google's tentacles spread from search to television to mobile phones to driverless cars to the Internet of Things to cloud computing. Facebook went from social networking to IM to Instagram to the work of Carolyn Everson's growing armies of marketing teams. Imagine the advantages Facebook will reap if, as Carolyn Everson predicts, it adds a buy button to facilitate e-commerce for its advertisers. Digital frenemies follow the immortal words of George Washington Plunkett. I seen my opportunities, and I took 'em. Asked what Facebook and Google's real designs on advertising were, a central player in the digital world with deep ties to both companies says he would honestly answer if he could speak anonymously. The answer, he says, begins with the fact that executives below the top in the ad world who perform much of the copywriting and art and account work are poorly paid and no match for the talent at companies like Facebook and Google. I think what Facebook and Google see is, oh my God, this is the gang that couldn't shoot straight and they've been given the keys to the U.S. Treasury. If we could just get our shit together marginally better than these jokers, we'd be rolling in dough. There's an arrogance there, but a valid arrogance. He was dubious that digital companies would try to compete by creating ads because that business doesn't scale, since it's not reliant on machines and algorithms. But he had no doubt they would come after media agencies like Irwin Gottlieb's Group M. No question they're competitors. Frenemies was Martin's word. I think he was just trying to be polite. The digital companies try to be equally polite because they still have to go through the gatekeeping of a Group M or a WPP. But in the end, it's a battle of two cultures, mathmen versus madmen. Martin Sorrell was not polite when he said worries about a third digital giant, Amazon, sometimes kept him awake nights. With almost half of all online retail sales and a wealth of the most valuable consumer data, Amazon knows what sells and what doesn't. They provide 25% of all cloud computing, Sorrell says. They don't share their data. Increasingly, they enter WPP's client businesses, making products that compete with what Unilever and P&G sell, taking on Walmart, buying TV shows, selling food and produce. If I ask my clients what they worry about most, Sorrell says, they say Amazon. With the data they have, he frets that Amazon will slide into the advertising business, offering to help target and place the ads of his clients, supplanting Group M. Mobile phones pose another existential threat. They have already fundamentally transformed the ad and marketing business. And when 5G replaces 4G and 3G speeds for mobile devices sometime in the next several years, nearly matching the broadband speeds of cable or telephone fiber, the impact should be profound. A movie can be downloaded in an eye blink. Annoying download waits will disappear, providing a boost to all video, including video ads and virtual reality. Driverless cars, which must ping other cars on the road many times each second to avoid crashes, will receive a boost, as will robotics. The varied devices that make up the Internet of Things will seamlessly communicate. A decade ago, most digital content was text. By 2016, half was video and photos. Advertisers know that the most effective mobile ads engage the consumer with video. This experience can only be enhanced with 5G. Once, when information about products was scarce, consumers learned about products from advertising. The consumer was hungry for information and traded their time for it. Today, as marketing consultant Gord Hotchkiss wrote for online publication MediaPost, the basic premise of advertising has changed. Information is no longer scarce. In fact, through digitization, we have the opposite problem. We have too much information and too little attention to allocate to it. We now need to filter information. Advertising that attempts to sell feels false, intrusive. Available ad-free options, Netflix, HBO, Showtime, YouTube, reinforce the desire to watch television the way we watch movies, without interruption. This desire is further reinforced by social networks, which accustom citizens to two-way communication. The new central verb for us in marketing is listen, Hannah Grove, the executive vice president and CMO for asset manager State Street, said at a Financial Times marketing conference. We're all humans, and we don't want to be marketed to. We've gone from a cathedral to a marketplace. What we definitely do know is that sending ad messages to our very personal mobile phones, whether over 5G or 4G, is fraught with both danger and opportunity for advertisers. Terry Kawaja of Luma Partners holds up his iPhone and says, "This thing fundamentally changes everything. We have never had a media channel like this one. We've never had a media channel that's personal, that's gone with us. The ubiquity. Everyone has a phone. And the persistence, it's always with you. And the functionality, I can buy something online, I can get to a website, I can make a phone call." He is optimistic that in the long run, advertisers will figure out how to better market their products. But he concedes the peril when he adds, "Advertising was constructed on the notion of interruption. In an era of mobile phones and social networks, word of mouth becomes the killer marketing tool. Power has dramatically shifted to the consumer." Or as NBC Entertainment Chairman Bob Greenblatt declared at a late November 2017 forum sponsored by his network, "Consumers hate advertising. People are running away from advertising in droves, and so that, to me, is the crux of the problem. How do we stop that from happening?" Artificial intelligence poses another existential threat to advertising. Rashad Tabakawala thinks of AI as the third disruptive era, a seismic shift as profound as the introduction of the internet browser in the 1990s, followed by the iPhone in 2007, and what it meant for social networks. All the data AI collects in the cloud from search and social networks and stores allows the machine to figure out who to talk to, and all these ingredients write software with the ability to create an ad or an individualized message. Tabakawala's prognostications are supported by a late 2016 global marketing survey that reported that more than half of CMOs expected AI's impact on marketing and communications to exceed the impact of social media. Just the increased use of virtual assistants like Amazon's Alexa or Microsoft's Cortana will translate to what they call programmatic consumption. Instead of a consumer spending time selecting a product and placing an order, these will be automated. In other words, purchase decisions will increasingly be made by computers, rather than by consumers standing in shops. Joe Schoendorf, a veteran venture capitalist at Accel Partners in Silicon Valley, imagines a time when AI installs software in your refrigerator. With barcodes on the bottles and containers, the sensors in the refrigerator will send replacement orders to your store when the milk is low, or will tell you of a generic product that can save you 18%. How is an agency going to market to machines? And when AI is fully developed and you have machines talking to machines and machines can produce ads, what's the agency's value now? More ominous for the agencies, he adds, I think Amazon has already figured this out. And the Amazon Dot, a voice-controlled device connected to Alexa, is the first incarnation of this strategy. James Whitaker at Microsoft says, in a world of data, you may not need ads. Machines will determine the cheapest prices and take the guessing out of deciphering what the consumer wants. Once you know the consumer's intent, why do you need a creative ad? Or an agency, since, he says, the store or the brand can communicate directly with the consumer, ushering in what marketers hail as one-to-one marketing. This brave new world is not imminent, concedes Whitaker. Figuring out a consumer's intent is revolutionary, he says, but change usually occurs incrementally. And maybe machines will be unable to decode a person's intent, or unable to create marketing messages that move consumers emotionally, or to supply the human judgment we call wisdom. Enter programmatic advertising, which relies on AI. While programmatic has grown more slowly than some predicted, and has been successfully resisted by Les Moonves and TV network sales forces, today a majority of digital display ads are automated. And a 2016 study by Zenith Programmatic Marketing forecasts predicted it would swell from $5 billion in the United States in 2012 to $64 billion in 2018, although its growth lags in the rest of the world. Our Manhattan Project is programmatic advertising, says Bob Pittman, CEO of iHeartMedia. If we invented radio today, we would call it digital. Yet we still sell advertising the same old way. To automate sales is quick and easy and reliant on a wealth of data, he says. Unlike TV, whose big audience is at night when viewers are home, his radio audience is all day, so he believes he has a shot at locating consumers when they are about to shop, thus demonstrating to advertisers the effectiveness of his radio ads. If programmatic buying spreads to all platforms, including television, many questions arise, led by, since the machines buy audiences, not space on websites or TV channels, how do marketers prevent their friendly ads from appearing on unfriendly sites, as happened in 2016? A central future question for marketers becomes, how to reach consumers with messages that don't feel like an annoying and interruptive sales pitch. Too slowly, the industry has begun to address this question. Think how slow the ad world has been to stop relying on annoying banner and pop-up ads. Think of those TV ads that hog about 20 minutes of each cable or broadcast hour. Think of the products you just purchased online that appeared constantly in ads on your Gmail screen. Why did it take Google until June 2017 to announce it would terminate these? Designing the Apple Store as a tourist attraction as well as a service center has been a brilliant marketing tool for Apple. Starbucks stores attracted more traffic by creating a community spirit with free Wi-Fi. Elon Musk's Tesla does no advertising, yet news of this innovative and stylish electric car has propelled Tesla's stock above that of most other auto companies. Advertisers have begun to recycle the brought-to-you-by approach once so popular that in 1950, three of the top-rated shows on television were NBC's Texaco Star Theater, the Philco Television Playhouse, and the Colgate Comedy Hour. The impediment to a sponsor paying for a half or full hour of programming is, of course, financial. The cost of each episode of a one-hour drama would be north of $5 million, and a lot more for a hit, whereas the cost of producing and placing a 30-second ad would be about $300,000. Today, as we've seen, instead of the General Electric Theater, General Electric offers Breakthrough, a series it co-developed with the National Geographic Channel, directed by such renowned storytellers as Peter Berg and Ron Howard. The cost is not extravagant. Instead of a brought-to-you-by-GE banner announcement at the beginning of an episode, it weaves GE scientists into the script. This form of product placement has enjoyed a comeback. Fox's empire took it further. Pepsi didn't just pay for the sight of a Pepsi bottle. Pepsi was integrated into the storyline when an actor competed for a Pepsi performer contract. More blatant sales pitches were adopted by former ad man Donnie Deutsch. On his USA Network show Donnie, his character faces the camera and rhapsodizes about Hack's BBQ sauce and Purity Vodka, two sponsors. Deutsch's pitch is bolder than the Jack Benny show when Benny extolled Lucky Strike cigarettes or Jell-O. In the future, Les Moonves predicts, there will be more sponsored shows on CBS, more product placement, and more experimentation with shorter interruptive ads, with 6-second pop-up ads replacing 30-second commercials. But he did not plan to follow the lead of NBC, Fox, and Turner Broadcasting, who vowed to reduce the number of commercial minutes and charge a premium for what they assumed was more exclusivity. "I think our ad load works," he says, stressing that 65% of CBS's viewers watch their programs in real time. However, Fox did produce some contrary evidence. By reducing its ad loads by 20% for the Teen Choice Awards in August 2017, advertiser prices went up, and the show produced one-third more revenue than it did in 2016. Inevitably, other marketing moves will substitute for interruptive ads. Witness popular Red Bull concerts, or brand names on the shirts of professional sports teams or their stadiums and arenas. Still another surging form of marketing, IPG's Michael Roth thinks, will be rewarding consumers with discounts as long as they're relevant to the particular consumer. Advertisers will know more about individual consumers, for example, what they search for, allowing car manufacturers to target potential car buyers. Artificial intelligence will say, "This guy buys a car every 2 years." 6 months before the 2 years come up, they inundate him with messages. "We know it's time for you to be looking for a new car. Here's $2,000 off if you come in next week to buy a car." That's relevant. Digitally connected cars will have smart windshields that flash to the driver who is low on gas, where the nearest gas station is located, along with an offer of a free coffee. Or a food order can be placed and picked up at a nearby fast food restaurant. Of course, exchanging intrusively annoying ads for intrusively annoying marketing messages may be no less irritating to consumers. At the same time, native ads are becoming ever more craftily camouflaged. Gary Vaynerchuk writes, "Eventually, ads won't look like ads anymore. They will all be natively woven into the platforms, and will consume them without even knowing it." The ANA estimated in mid-2016 that spending on native ads would grow from $13.9 billion in 2016 to $21 billion in 2018. "To a significant extent, native is the future of advertising for us," New York Times CEO Mark Thompson says. Adjacent advertising, which is more than a century old in newspapers, and is when someone is looking at content and their eye can be drawn to an advertising message which is adjacent to the content, that is a model of limited value in the world we're heading into. There is no sort of white space on a smartphone screen. And so our expectation is advertising will be part of the content stream people consume. He predicts that both the interruptive ad and the adjacent ad model will fade. Although Thompson believes The Times has hired the journalistic storytellers and has advertiser relationships that allow it to build and sustain native advertising, critics raise red flags. They chorus. Like advertorials, these can compromise the integrity of both the media and the brand. Another enormous impediment, says Rob Fishman of Niche, a software company that recruited influencers to market native ads and was sold to Twitter, is scale. Because native ads have to be shaped differently for each platform, targeted to various audience segments, are not as repeatable, and each has to endure a laborious storytelling process, he says, native is the enemy of scale. The monolithic ad model breaks down. As we've also seen more and more, brands latch on to the idea of championing a larger movement or cause, extolling the good they do. This is not entirely new. Volvo in the 1980s chose not to compete with sleek car designs, but to promote car safety. IKEA democratized stylish furniture for those with modest incomes. Patagonia flourished by conveying to consumers that it had a social purpose, using recycled bottles to make fleece jackets, employing solar power for their headquarters, donating a portion of their revenue to improve the environment. But the growing unpopularity of big business has prompted brands to dress differently. Every year, Edelman issues what it calls its Trust Barometer, a global survey contrasting the level of trust toward business and other institutions of the informed public versus the mass population. In 2016, they reported a significant divide, with nearly two-thirds of the informed public trusting business and other institutions, and under half of the mass population sharing that trust, with the divide widening as the income gap spread. Brands that promote the good they do, as Unilever and P&G and Colgate did, seek to demonstrate that they value more than just making money. There's a money reason for this as well. Vaseline or detergents or toothpaste are commodity products, with little to distinguish them. Scott Goodson founded his 50-person advertising and marketing agency, Strawberry Frog, and chose the name as a way to differentiate his company. They decided a frog was more agile, and research told them that the strawberry frog from the Amazon has a red body and blue legs, so it looked like a rebel with jeans. A perfect symbol for an agency designed to create movements to sell what he deems to be worthwhile products. He wrote a book about how marketers can help companies build brands and help change the world. He rejects Rosser Reeves' unique selling proposition because, he says, there are today too many unique platforms, and most products are commodities with competitors constantly subverting them by offering lower prices. What companies must do is differentiate on values. You differentiate on your point of view in the world. That's the only way you differentiate. So he sells Nature's Variety, a nutritious dog food, the way he says he would use a wedge issue in a political campaign. The company has mounted a movement to save the 9,000 sheltered pets killed daily in the United States. Goodson acknowledges the corrosive values marketing sometimes promotes. I admit marketing can be evil, he says, and can be manipulative and make people spend their money when they shouldn't, and sometimes on things that are bad for them, and maybe more often than not. But I also think companies have tremendous power, and when power is wielded in the right way, they can tackle some of the big issues that we face in society. It's in the interests of these companies that they solve some of these big issues. The environment is falling apart? Yes, they should fix it. Otherwise, they will have fewer consumers. Straining to convey their goodness can backfire on brands, as Pepsi learned in the spring of 2017. Pepsi made a 2-minute, 39-second video of a millennial protest march while reality TV star Kendall Jenner posed for a modeling assignment. It is not clear what they're protesting, but the march slowly seduces Jenner, who keeps looking over at the marchers before receiving a beckoning nod from a nice-looking male protester, and finally joins the march to cheers. She grabs a cold can of Pepsi, strides to a wall of policemen in riot gear, and hands the Pepsi to a cop, who takes a swig to more cheers. The screen fills with these bold white letters. Join the conversation. Viewers are left with the impression that protest marches would be more effective if protesters shared a Pepsi. The Twitter and Facebook jury did not take long to rage. Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter, Bernice King, tweeted, "If only Daddy would have known about the power of hashtag Pepsi." Pepsi quickly yanked the online ad before it graduated to TV. Animating Pepsi was the same quest it shares with other brands who are convinced they must build relationships with consumers, become brand stewards, and demonstrate their authenticity. On the other hand, there are marketing campaigns that do good while doing well for the corporation. One such campaign was designed by the McCann New York agency for the financial firm State Street Global Advisors. It contains a 50-inch tall statue, Fearless Girl, planted on the sidewalk glaring at Wall Street's charging bull. It is a proud bronzed girl, her fists jammed into her hips, her chest out, her implicit message that more women belong in leadership positions. The company designed the statue to promote its She Fund, which invests in companies that recruit women for top jobs. When Fearless Girl won 3 Grand Prix awards on the first day of the 2017 Cannes Lions Festival, jury president Wendy Clark announced that the She Fund was up 374% since Fearless Girl struck her pose on a Wall Street sidewalk. Another compelling example of a fresh form of advertising and marketing is Citibike, New York City's bike-sharing program. Launched in May 2013 by Citibank for zero tax dollars and at a cost to the bank of $41 million, by the summer of 2017, it had 10,000 bikes in use in 55 city neighborhoods. As Andrew Essex observes in his 2017 book, The End of Advertising, Citibank, by choosing not to spend this sum on TV commercials or squandering that 8-figure investment on useless pollution, built something additive that actually reduces our carbon footprint. The benefit to Citibank in New York and New Jersey, where Citibike has been introduced, was equally clear. Essex shows, by 2015, the bank's internal data revealed that favorable impressions of Citibank rose 28 points to 72%, and people who said they would consider acquiring a product from Citibank climbed 43 points. But since Citibank is a worldwide business, to impact its overall favorable impression by extending Citibike globally would be as costly as a massive 30-second TV ad campaign. Whatever form advertising and marketing takes in coming years, certainty is that data-fed targeting will be a pillar. Erwin Gottlieb believes that in the future, agencies will have to guarantee results to clients, and better results will boost agency compensation. We can also be certain that privacy will remain a third rail to marketers, always worried that governments will grow alarmed and impose regulations. The European Union, for example, passed legislation scheduled to go into effect in May 2018, restricting the ability of companies to collect personal information without the user's consent. Some, like Andrew Robertson of BBDO, believe that the blizzard of different platforms and better targeting will place a premium on creative advertising that captures people's attention and will invite advertisers to spend more to lure those identified as potential customers, as advertising spending becomes more cost-effective. Others, like Michael Kassin, offer a bleaker view. My biggest fear is that the inextricable link that existed historically between serving up content financed by commercial messages, that link is broken because consumers can get their content without commercials now. Think what it would have cost you to get Life magazine if there were no ads in it. It was subsidized by advertising. But today, too many people just won't watch commercials. So what replaces the commercials? We will live in a subscription world, he boldly, and I believe wrongly, answers. Tim Wu is among the most prominent advocates for replacing ads with subscriptions. Harking back to 1833 and the first ad-subsidized newspaper, the New York Sun, He calls this the original sin. In his provocative book, The Attention Merchants, Wu argues that in advertiser-supported media, the reader or viewer is not the customer. The advertiser is. Thus, letting advertisers into the tent inevitably means a diminution of quality, because advertisers pressure the platform to deliver a bigger audience. More news about Kim Kardashian magnetizes an audience. The way to improve media is to pay for it, he says, preferably with subscriptions and micropayments. Wu is not alone. In February 2017, Twitter co-founder Evan Williams, who had raised $134 million to improve journalism by forming Medium, an ad-supported blogging and publishing site, announced that he was laying off one-third of his staff and ending its reliance on ads. Echoing Wu, he told Business Insider that ad-driven media was broken because corporations fund it in order to advance their goals. We believe people who write and share ideas should be rewarded on their ability to enlighten and inform, not simply their ability to attract a few seconds of attention. When Jim VandeHei left as CEO of Politico in 2016 to start a provocative online publication, Axios, he assailed the crap trap of trashy clickbait designed to attract more page views and thus to satisfy advertisers. The trap was set by a reliance on ads. For Axios to produce quality journalism, he said, readers will have to pay up, and if they need and love the product, they will, and gladly so. The thoughts are noble. The analysis of what often ails advertising-supported content is correct. But the economics don't support the noble idea. The economics of Axios certainly doesn't support VandeHei's bold words. For roughly 90% of Axios's revenues, one of their principal investors says, comes from corporate sponsorships, or advertisers who are granted a sandwiched paragraph and often a picture introduced with headlines like this, a message from Bank of America. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump didn't agree on much in the 2016 presidential contest, but they did agree that most Americans in the middle were being squeezed, their incomes frozen. Although median income did rise between 2014 and 2015, it was little changed from the pre-recession year 2007. The census reports that median household income in 2009 was $54,988. By 2015, it had inched up to only $56,516. And those just below median income but above the poverty line saw their income drop. The Brookings Hamilton Project found that, after adjusting for inflation, wages in the U.S. rose just 0.2% over the past 40 years. Think about the subscription toll today, including mobile phone, broadband, cable or satellite TV, newspaper and magazine subscriptions, Netflix, HBO or Showtime, Amazon Prime, apps, music. Jeffrey Cole, who teaches at USC, says the average household pays monthly subscription charges of $267 per month, which does not include electricity, gas, and other unavoidable monthly bills. How do most overstretched consumers pay more? They probably don't. There are, of course, successful efforts to reduce dependence on advertising. Hulu is growing its subscriber base. The Apple App Store rang up $2.7 billion in subscriptions in 2016. Spotify's subscriber base swelled from 30 million to 50 million in 2016. Amazon's Prime membership, for a modest annual fee of $99, offers an estimated 60 million subscribers free delivery, free streamed movies and television shows, free music and other enticements. The New York Times' reliance on advertising revenue has been cut from 80% to about 40%. But unlike most newspapers, the Times, like the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times, could pull off this feat because they successfully raised the subscription price and their affluent readers were willing to pay. Some novel experiments to lessen reliance on advertising have also been tried. Rather than impose a paywall to deny free online access to news stories, a practice followed by most newspapers, The Guardian provides open access. But at the bottom of each story, they append this. Since you're here, we have a small favor to ask. If everyone who reads our reporting, who likes it, helps fund it, our future would be much more secure. For as little as $1, you can support The Guardian. Readers can then click on a credit card or PayPal link. A total of 300,000 readers volunteered a contribution, the Nieman Lab reported in November 2017. Another 500,000, they reported, either